Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sophie from London, and you're listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything. My question is, why are some men so weird about taking up activities like knitting or sewing? Okay, here comes the show, and remember, question everything.
Hello everybody, and welcome to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast where myself, comedian, writer, and occasional actor Dane Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello!
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Sophie from London's question, why are some men so weird about taking up activities like knitting or sewing? Dane, this has a Dane Baptiste slam dunk answer written all over it, mate. Go for it.
I would say myself, I don't have any problem sewing. I went to a technology college, and so I had to do a bit of study with textiles. So if I need to load a sewing machine or to restitch a sock or a hole in a pair of sweatpants, I can do that. I consider that to be very practical. But I think in answer to Sophie's question, I think a lot of the time we live in a world where we tend to be so rigid about ideas about the masculine and feminine. Anything that pertains to feminine is supposed to be for women, when that's not really the case, because the humanities, creative arts are all, the prosperity or ability to thrive within those kind of fields of study is based on the feminine hemisphere of your brain. So the feminine side deals with creativity, but some people resist that. So some men are weird about taking it up because also they realise if they prove they can do it, then women won't do it for them. It's like, so I have an old housemate who used to do like a shit job of washing up because he thought, I'd just be like, fine, I'll just do it then. No, you stay there until you get it right.
Sophie, as promised, a slam dunk Dane Baptiste answer. And on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely. People can feel free to ask whatever they want. We will never feel like we've been stitched up. I only did that because... Oh. Howard, you're a dad. That was for you. What are you growing at?
I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it. It's a joyful growth.
Yeah, growing is how you enjoy it. Oh, man. Who have I become? We answer all the questions. No question is too big, small, or stupid for this particular podcast. And if you like the show, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify. You'll never miss an episode. Or subscribe to us on Acast, the world's largest podcast network, where you can see our conversations with all of the very special guests we have on the show. With that being said, on today's show is a British political activist. He's the co-founder of the pro-European Union advocacy group Our Future, Our Choice. At the age of 27, he left his job and moved into his parents' loft to become a campaigner against Brexit because he was frustrated that the pro-Remain argument was not being made effectively by mainstream politicians. He has also regularly appeared on television as a political commentator and has written for The Independent, The Guardian and The Metro. So far as the Brexit narrative, he is still fighting the good fight. So please welcome to the show Femi, better known as Femi Oluwole.
Pleasure to be here. Yeah, once when I was on BBC News, they actually called me Femi Sorry as if that was my actual last name.
That's amazing. Did you get them to change it?
I just had to look at the presenter like, what are you doing?
does it even sound like a name to you?
I mean, Femi, I do this show every week with this, you know, me and Dane, right? And I research our guest. And you know what? I've got an 8-month-old child. And you know what? I've got other things to do, like my job. But it still doesn't take much to work out that you've got a fucking surname, does it?
Yeah. Twitter handle happens to be everyone's. I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous. But hey, I guess that maybe they couldn't pronounce Oluwole.
Yeah, but at the same time, there is no other person with the surname Sorry.
This is true.
So even that would have been a point of conversation. That even if that believed that she believed that to be your surname, wouldn't she be like, you know, that's an interesting name. Where's that from?
Agreed.
And it allows you to potentially create a really great middle name, like Never. Or
Well, basically, or... I came up with it because I know that I tend to basically say whatever is right and blunt, regardless of how the sensitivities involved. And so I figured an inbuilt apology in my username would be the smart way to go.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a smart way to go. Not the easiest path, as I'm sure you're aware.
No. Not exactly.
But it's got to be done. I too find myself always in these very contentious spaces, saying what needs to be said without taking heed of, I suppose, European paternalistic fragility. You know the thing. I mean, you know the thing.
Of course.
I mean, you're in a really interesting case of the power of the internet, Femi, I think. You know, not that it's impossible to say that we may have kind of discovered you without the internet if it hadn't existed, but it's obviously served you incredibly incredibly well in some ways. In other ways, not so much. But
yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, back in 2016, I had 16 followers in January. And I'm about to go over 300,000. So back in the day, as they say, in June 2016, I remember I went to Primark, got a white T-shirt, wrote in felt-tip pen, EU questions just asked, and stood in the center of Birmingham City Centre, just basically waiting for people to talk to me because I had zero platform. And Twitter has given me a voice that it's a very privileged position to be in, but it took a long time to get there.
Yeah. Oh no, and very much earned, and obviously definitely speaks to the fact that, you know, there was pretty much a void in the market of political or socio-political discourse that needed it, and from a voice that we can trust. You know, I think a large part of these issues always is the impotence that has come with politics, where people just feel so disconnected that I don't think they even rely on politicians to even give an explanation of policy, which is strange, but.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's simply ridiculous. I should not have been able to do what I did.
Yeah.
One random, especially in an issue so utterly violently oppositional, where people were all shouting, trying to clamor for airspace, I shouldn't have been able to rise as fast as I did in the Twitter sphere, because there should have been larger politicians saying the right things, giving people the facts, understanding both sides. It's because of their failures that I've been able to do what I've done.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, you know, there's glass half full. I think it maybe will in future help people to scrutinize actions of their politicians a lot more. Or at least I think the main thing has been that, you know, I think if you work through people like yourself, has allowed it to be a capitalist, whereby a capitalist, so that now when people even hear the term something like referendum, that's never going to be something I overlook, because I still goes, I mean, my own really real observation I made about Brexit, so far as the outcome of the initial referendum, is that I think a lot of people underestimated, you know, how incompetent politicians can be if they're not engaging actively with you. And also, I think a lot of people definitely underestimated the, you know, sentiment, or the Anglo-imperial sentiment outside of London. And also, you know, the people that have been disenfranchised by the regulation and by neoliberalism and by, you know, economic focus being on London for so many years. And a lot of people that really just don't understand how the Maastricht Treaty and the European Union works is probably the main one. So...
Yeah, well, then that's the problem. There were very different groups within the Brexit voting population. There are those who are your Farage types, who it's all about ethno-nationalism, etc., and xenophobia. But the biggest revelation that I had from that vote was the realization that it was utterly wrong to judge all Brexit voters by the standards of Nigel Farage.
Yeah.
And when I'm speaking to Remainers who just say, I have no idea how anybody could possibly vote for Brexit, I tell them, all right, put yourself in the shoes of somebody who was born in Redcar or Sunderland, an area that gets nothing from Westminster and hasn't done for 40 years. Your dad lost his job because Thatcher closed the shipyards, and you've seen no investment in your area for 40 years, while London's had the Millennium Dome, the London Eye, underground tube systems, and your vote means nothing because Labour always wins and the Tories always lose, so there's no incentive to do anything for you. And then here comes along Brexit, and the person telling you to vote for status quo is the same person who's put you through 8 years of austerity. No, you vote Leave. Unless you happen to be an expert in all issues of EU law, you vote Leave.
It was that simple in some ways, wasn't it? But we're going to get into all this and more. But it's probably time for a question, isn't it, Dane, as the format of this show dictates?
Absolutely. Very in direct opposition to the Brexit vote, we like to establish a landscape for very open and direct discourse. By that token, Femi, we thank you for coming to the podcast and invite you to ask our first question, which is the only question you'd like to ask, which we'll discuss for 50 minutes and some change, then Howard will do the same, then lather, rinse, repeat. I'll ask the final question, which we'll discuss for 50 minutes, and then we'd like to leave a space so that those who are intrigued by your questions can find out more about you and where they can find you. Then we all go on to live hopefully prosperous lives, irrespective of the referendum. How does that sound?
Excellent.
Cool. So the floor is yours, my good man.
Okay, my question would be, is logic more important than emotion?
Oh, I love it. It's philosophical, it's ethical. It's also based on the fact that the world's gone fucking mad. You know, it's great. Well, I'm going to have to ask Femi, as I often like to, what inspired your question?
So I'm somebody who, as a result of some childhood trauma, ended up having to sort of very much segregate my brain in terms of emotions and logic, just to basically keep myself on a level playing field. And I realized from an early age that if you allow emotions to dictate your actions, you're not acting because of a rational analysis of how will my actions affect other people. You're acting based on how will my actions deal with the emotions that I'm currently feeling. And so you're more likely to make more selfish decisions if emotion is your driving force rather than logic, especially as the people who were responsible for the trauma I experienced, I was also able to, even from an early age, recognize that it was their inability to control their emotions that led to the trauma happening. And so when I look at things, if you apply that to politics, most people think that they're in the right, but, and even some politicians who are doing things that most people would say is objectively wrong, in their head, they think they're doing the right thing. And there is only one objective truth on this. You can add up the pros and cons, the negative effects and the positive effects, and there is one objective truth. Yet in their head, they think they're doing the right thing because of how it makes them feel. They feel they're doing the wrong thing. So a leaning towards a prioritization of feelings over logic ends up with more a narrower view of how your actions will affect other people.
This is an incredible one to unwrap, isn't it? And you kind of have to, and I know Dane often enjoys going down this road,
really.
Looking at America and the role America has played in international identity and culture is something that springs to my mind when I hear that question, Femi, because America is a very, very emotional country and very, very motivated by emotion, I'd say, perhaps more so than any country. Mm-hmm. And I think, that whole stiff upper lip British thing, you know, it's obviously, you know, nonsense and leads to repressive problems in many people. but the Americans are almost kind of at the, I don't know, in some ways, what do you think, Dane? At the opposite end of the spectrum, and emotion defies all logic for them because that's how I feel, man.
It's a really interesting point, the dichotomy of both of them, because I guess the human existence, so far as interacting with other human beings or experience of life, especially socially, is probably guided by those two two states of being, of being logical or being emotional. And I don't know, I think for you to be rounded and to thrive in society, it needs to be a combination of both. But I think, and by that reason I say that is because I tend to find that emotions such as fear normally are the precursor to the abandonment of logic. So I think there are probably, it's a hard thing because obviously there are a lot of phenomena let's look for our country, for example, where there are a lot of phenomena where you would say it's very easy for this to be an issue that would be solved if you do apply logic. Like for me, for example, I find that if you live in a country whereby your universal healthcare system is at its optimal level, then that could only serve for there to be an higher output of people or citizens who have high access to healthcare would be more productive people and would then, for on a larger scale, contribute more positively to whatever your country's indicators of success are, whether it's a GDP or a balance of payments, et cetera, et cetera. But by the same token, I guess that notion obviously stirs some kind of emotion within people and tends to stifle that kind of thing from happening. So
the real answer to the very kind of blunt, you know, is logic more important than emotion, would be, in my view, it depends what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And so, for example, we obviously have a politically active man on our show today. And when it comes to politics, I think you do have to use a lot more logic at times than emotion, because you are trying to solve a problem that if you became overcome with emotion, it would not be the right way to solve it. Whereas I would argue that if you're trying to solve issues with your love life, you should have some logic. There needs to be some logic. But I think you can also trust your emotions.
Maybe that's what you're right, Hal. Maybe that's what it is. Is the issue really about whether to employ logic or emotion? Or is it more the fact that understanding that both of those states of being are very subjective? Because I suppose what appears to be logical to some people might seem like insanity to another. So, for example, I guess you could argue logically, if you are a conservative member of parliament and you're trying to maintain your power base, it is logical for you to continue to perpetuate sentiments of xenophobia and conservatism and corporatism amongst voters, and kind of, you know, continue to inculcate people with this idea of right of centre, Blairite kind of political theory. But then I suppose you can understand the logic behind that and why it would work, but then I suppose your emotion in the form of maybe your conscience or your sense of empathy would dictate you to understand why that is kind of illogical. So
yeah, Femi, where do you heard us answer a bit of the question. Where do you stand on it?
So on that last issue around how it affects a presentable conservative thinking that they're doing the right thing, if you look at what is the difference between left and right, it comes down to who benefits from your policy. So on the extreme end of the left, you've got we want policies that benefit everybody equally. And on the extreme end of the right, you've got we want policies that benefit the specific group, be it a specific race, a specific gender, a specific religious group, etc. But the reason why you get people on the right feeling that they're doing the moral thing is because they in themselves feel a stronger emotional connection to the specific group that they're fighting for, and as a result, they feel they're doing the right thing by the people that really matter to them, and that's how, if you allow emotions to affect to dictate your reasoning, it can lead to morally negative outcomes, and how that links again to if you're dealing with a relationship. The phrase that I often use is emotion should be fuel for the engine, but never anywhere near the steering wheel.
That's good. That's a really good way of putting it. Yeah.
So you can use emotional intelligence to figure out what somebody else is feeling. Use your logic to figure out what someone else is feeling. And based on that, use the empathy you get from that to drive you to do the most logical thing to help that other person, especially in the context of relationship. So that's how emotions are necessary, but they shouldn't necessarily dictate how you act.
Because in terms of Brexit, which is a useful thing to compare emotion versus logic, the emotion, and in some cases the wrong kind of emotion, although there was some emotion that inspired the Brexit, you know, event, that had justification. You know, there are some elements of all that emotion that came out that requires attention. But it won out in a really bizarre, incoherent way, didn't it? and it never, you know, I mean, it would be fascinating to think that in maybe when we're old men, that you'll see some kind of different version of it where, you know, I still think, you know, the only solution to the world's problems is for all the countries to work together in a very coherent way. And that's not emotion, I think. That's logic, isn't it? That's the logic of surviving on a planet that has limited resources.
Exactly.
that's not too difficult for people to get their heads around, right, Dane?
I think the whole thing about fueling the engine is probably the best way you can put it. And I just think, there's definitely got to be I think there's definitely a duality. There is a duality in which both can exist. But I think, yeah, maybe it's the application of which I think logic, when people are presenting something in the form of a social science, I guess the study of society and people's stratification of groups and tribes, it's quite a it's a very quantitative field. You can basically understand that, like, if you're going to use a system like democracy, then on that basis, then you would logically think that people who have a higher level of representation in particular areas would be entitled to have more of a dominant control over government policy. But then you look at a phenomenon like colonialism, that is kind of in direct contradiction to that. So it's kind of illogical in that respect. So I would say, I mean, I guess in some ways you could argue that, like I said, I guess it's a harder question to answer because the notion of logic and the notion of emotion can both be seen as very subjective. So it's what's logic to some people, and like you said, protects some people, and a logical idea driven by an emotional need or compulsion will make logical sense to one group and be completely logical to another group.
And the consequence of that is that even if you were to buy into the logic of this group means you protect this group, even if it's creates animosity towards another group, is that as a whole, the result of that is, well, we can see it in America, we can see it in the UK. Those societies are both significantly weaker because of the inequality.
Yes.
Because of the inequality, because of the binary nature of politics, because of the antagonism between left and right, those countries are both weaker.
Which was lent to a real display of, you know, of the illogical, despite trying to appear to be, you know, the idea of bipartisan political infrastructure is supposed to be, you know, secular and not based on emotion. But essentially, like you said, I would argue, maybe you could argue, most logical and progressive ideology begins with an emotional belief. So are they necessarily completely distinct from one another? So, for example, I guess there are certain practices in terms of maybe within the paradigm of family, which it's logical to arm your family members with or to avoid any kind of external trauma. But by the same token, having, you know, the emotional awakening of being, having trauma inflicted on you or being aware of, you know, having a non-conventional familial unit, again, it would be logical to maybe be distanced from that and it'd be logical to understand that family isn't just a function of sharing the same genetics as somebody. So, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say in terms of answering the question is, my short answer would be kind of that it's very hard to separate the two. Hence me saying, yeah, in terms of the emotion being the fuel but not steering the wheel, I think is really the best way of quantifying the answer.
I think you can't have one without the other, really. Yeah. I think you have to in some ways, it's like that idea that power corrupts, right? I think these things kind of feed each other.
But then, yeah, but I suppose it's like, do you remember the film I, Robot with Will Smith?
Yeah.
Great. Yeah,
that's
love that.
An example where obviously the free lords of robotics, that a robot is supposed to preserve life. And what happens is that in a car crash, a car crashes into like a lake and it's falling off a bridge. But basically, there's a robot that comes along to save Will Smith and like a young kid. And the robot does the probability check of like the likelihood of saving them both. And because the probability of saving the child is so low, then he just saves Will Smith. And Will Smith is...
But that was somebody's baby.
Yeah, Will Smith's like somebody's baby. Like that you at least try it, but a robot doesn't really see it that way. So in that instance, does emotion override logic? I wouldn't necessarily say it does.
To use one final example, and this is from law, one of the reasons why I kind of gave up on being a lawyer is that I felt that the law itself wasn't really guided by morality. Mm-hmm. And the example that I used for this was it's called the Gauche test. It's basically the thing, the test that decides if somebody should be convicted of theft. Now, to get away with, to be deemed innocent in theft, you need to get something, but believe either A, the jury needs to think that what you did was honest, or B, the defendant needs to believe that the average person would consider their actions to
be honest. The reasonable man argument.
Yeah. Well, it's the defendant's perception of what the reasonable man is.
Yes.
Which is the important thing. Mm-hmm. Now, in that particular section of the test, it means that if you're somebody who believes that the average person would have also acted as you did, you're more likely to get off. Now, the problem with that is good people tend to have a higher view of what the common standard of morality is. So if you generally feel that all people should put other people first, you're more likely to find your actions to have been unacceptable, and therefore you're more likely to go to jail, whereas somebody who's a bad person and therefore has no sense of feeling of loyalty or community with his fellow citizen, you're more likely to think that what your actions were okay, and because most people would also act as you did, and therefore you're more likely to get off.
Yeah.
So it's actually a backwards way of the allowing emotions to get into that ends up in a perversion of justice.
And I think there's probably a longer conversation about who set that up as well, because, you know, when you think about the amount of times that people are supposed to be reviewed by a jury of their peers, and the people that are the jurors are not their peers.
You ain't my peer.
Yeah. I think a lot of the time.
No chance. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. And it kind of feeds into actually a little bit of kind of where my question was going to go. I'm excited to have you on the show, Femi, and thank you for that question. It's brilliant. Really, really interesting one. But the, I think it's weird to think about the history books, right, nowadays, because it feels like we're living through a really fucking weird period of history.
Mm.
And it's weird to think, well, maybe you don't think this is weird, I don't know, that you might come up in those history books, Femi. Because would have been a first tribe of online activists reaching a point of impact.
Mm.
And, you know, I wouldn't want to demean what you did in any way, but I think it's hugely down to the fact that people were disenfranchised with the current state of politics. And my question to you and Dane is a big, broad, sweeping one, which is, what kind of politics will positively engage people again? What is the future of politics if it was good? is maybe the simplest way of saying it.
So,
if you could just solve the world's problems for me in this next 15 minutes, that'd be great, basically, mate.
So I guess I can only speak from my own experience, and I've been told not to publicly self-analyze because it can come off either arrogant or say something that embarrasses myself. But if I were to think about what aspects of me have allowed me to grow in the last few years, it's A.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm completely okay with being wrong on certain issues. I don't claim to always be right. If I'm wrong, I admit to being wrong as soon as I find out new information. I'm willing to show my ignorance on certain issues, but I'm also I am ferociously determined to, if I know that I'm right on one issue, I'm ferociously determined to prove that point and bash out any arguments in my way to get to that truth. So honesty and humility in terms of what you don't know, and strength on what you do, is something that's missing. A little bit of compassion and empathy for those on the other side of the argument is something that, again, I feel that people will recognize as a value in me. I always try and argue from the perspective of the person I'm arguing with. I take what their ideology is and just basically work it through to its logical conclusion to point out any flaws if I believe there are some. So it's a less, even though it's confrontational, a less oppositional stance on things.
Yeah, so not as kind of finite, like this is what it is. And then if someone says, well, it's not, is it? You could actually back down and change your tactic or change your approach.
It comes down to also who I am as a person, because in terms of friendship, I value my friends based on their ability to call me out on my own bullshit.
So if I've got a friend who can convince me I'm wrong, I want to keep that friend around because I know how opinionated I am. And so I want to be challenged on things. And that general attitude to wanting to know the truth, regardless of how it makes me look or how or whether or not it weakens my argument, that level of honesty is one of the things that's missing in politics. And I think people want more of that.
Yeah, people are bored of it, Dane, aren't they? A lot of people are just sick of it. You meet, if someone told you they were met a politician, people just instantly don't trust them, right?
I mean, yeah, in many cases, and that's just basically just come from the level of detachment over years of systems becoming more and more archaic. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the same with all countries within the West, but I think when you contextualise, I suppose, political structures with the rise in capitalism and the resultant power that's come from people that have been able to enjoy the perks of capitalism, which would be like, I guess, your 1% or your ruling class in Republican nations. I think that there is a certain level of, adaptation that's come with the emerging political ideologies we have. So a lot of these have just been ideas that came out of the Second World War, whereby original ways of controlling and stratifying people, like along lines of religion or religious denomination, wouldn't really work for the world war. And also, I guess, having people to align behind a nation under the basis of imperial conquest for many nations who would have been on the losing side of the war, again, would have been a particularly useful ideology. So this is where a lot of them have come out. And I think, again, we're just at the point now where, we are just, at the apex of the efficacy of political systems as they existed before. And I just think, for example, the Labour Party is a shadow of what it once was. Not that the tenets of, you know, socialism or egalitarianism don't work anymore, but the incarnation under they work within Labour and Labour's ability to try and contextualise that existence alongside Conservatives doesn't really work anymore. So
what do you think they need to do?
For the Labour Party, I think they need to splinter. I think people that identify with the more classic ideas about socialism or Corbynistas, for lack of a better expression, should go one way, and people that adhere to the more Blairite ideas about left of centre and neoliberalism should form their own party.
Ultimately, I'd agree with you, but not yet.
Yeah. It's not as simple as tomorrow. Or with the same efficacy and the speed at which UKIP exists as almost like a shell party for the people that are too crazy to be Tories, then I don't think it'd be as quick as that. But I think ultimately the left wing as it exists, or what now comes under it, needs to be a lot more scrutinised. And I think that's come from, you know, I believe, from where social media has had a lot more of a nuanced democracy to political narratives. I just don't think that the political structures represent that just yet. And over the course of time, I think people really need to establish their principles and to try and be able to contextualise those in a world of, you know, global capitalism, as well as, you know, I think environmental and ecological policy is crucial to any kind of political narrative now as well. So I think, like I said, ultimately, I think it's time to move. But I just think there are new aspects of human existence which are going to require, you know, a very explicit political ideology in order to kind of manage those.
If we're talking about that line between left of centre and left, not my area of expertise. I'm aware of that divergence, and I think given the animosity between the two camps, I think ultimately we will need to get to a part where there are two different parties. However, the reason why we currently have Tories in power, the reason why, even though they got 44% of the vote, they have 100% of the power, is because there was essentially one party on the right and there were several parties on the left.
Yes.
As a result, in any constituency, if, for example, 30% vote Labour, 30% vote Lib Dem, 40% vote Tory, you're going to have a majority voting for centre, left of centre, and the minority voting for the right. The right will win in every constituency. If that happened in every constituency, you'd have all the MPs being Tories. So we simply do not have a political setup right now that will accommodate having multiple parties on the left. What needs to happen is there needs to be an acceptance that the next election, parties will put their political differences aside and form an electoral pact based on committing to electoral reform within the first 12 months of taking office. Because if all votes count equally, then it doesn't matter if Labour splits into 1,000 different parties, because you'll still get all the MP, you'll still get a progressive vote reflecting in a progressive parliament.
But when you think about 20, 30 years' time, if you were an advisor, or had an incredible... because there's loads of elements at play, right? Which I think, weirdly to me, don't feel left wing and right wing.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Howard. I mean, I think especially that. I think plutocracy and corporatism is kind of basically is the now
permanent. I was about to bring up Bezos. I was about to bring up Jeff Bezos. Like, you know, there's something that you could find them staunch right wing and staunch left wing people and go, well, of course Amazon should pay all their fucking tax. Like, what are you, what do you mean there? You know, there's nothing to do with racism or xenophobia or.
It's so difficult because then you have a world whereby, and this is the thing, on a larger scale, it's the entire system that will have to be overhauled, because I don't see how you can bemoan Amazon for not paying tax, then incentivize an HMRC to chase that tax. And how you incentivize them is with money. So if I was a tax evader and someone was like, you got to pay your tax, it's like, well, I can either pay my bill of how many millions and say my tax bill is like 30 million. I'm going to say to this guy, I'll pay you $500,000 if you go look the other way. So, I mean, on a large scale, capitalism and how it influences political ideology is something we'll definitely have to look at as well. Because while you live in a world, while that exists, and people can be incentivized financially, then it's going to be very hard to establish any effective political system that's going to look after people that are disenfranchised by the system of capitalism. Because, you know, it's like, for example, anyone who understood politics would know how embarrassing and how pointless it was for somebody like Donald Trump to become president. Because if you are a billionaire, you don't need to become president and have your indiscretions in the public eye. You can just lobby a politician and they can implement policies on your behalf. You don't have to be a complete fucking idiot and egotist and narcissist to still want to have your face out there, knowing full well that now you're going to go from the status of a billionaire where everyone is nice to you and answers to you, to you being the most answerable person in the free world. Mm-hmm. And the brain could have kind of foresaw that. So,
on the issue of what you said about how a racist could still want Amazon to pay their taxes, I think we do have a fundamental problem with the understanding of left and right, that it exists on multiple different levels. You could be left wing on corporate tax, but you could be right wing on race, aka a racist. And that problem is why you have people trying to label one side as one thing by grouping all the issues together, even though people are complex.
And hence what's called was referred to as Blexit in the States in the run up to the presidential election, whereby a number of black pundits and spokespeople like Candace Owens and Kanye West are trying to move the black caucus away, or the black voting caucus away from the Democratic Party, saying that because of the conflation of racism with the Republican Party, that it's supposed to be seen as a given that black people vote Democrats without it representing their needs. So I completely agree with that as well. And I think, it's the bipartisan political system as it exists, like you said, Femi, I think is now become very archaic. And like you said, because there's so much intersectionality in terms of the fact that, you know, the Ku Klux Klan was founded by people largely who would have been members of the Democratic Party for a large part of the white working class in America, who felt that their opportunities were going to become damaged, or they were going to lose their employment opportunities as a result of emancipation of slaves.
But I think there has to be things that unite people. That's to me the only, you know, and I think about...
Well, maybe we should ask, why are people so opposed to, like, when you hear people in discussions of politics, and obviously some of the more extreme ideas, like a QAnon et al., why are they also opposed to a new world order or a one world government? Now, I don't, it's not, this wasn't my question, but I'm just like, because we all understand that there are certain issues which have to kind of be united under, like, I think issues of ecology, sustainability are issues, our predisposition to potentially maybe disease and stuff, an issue like a pandemic. These are all, you know, where the policy in terms of dealing with these should all be quite universal. So that would need to happen first, I guess, before, or is it that political parties are really held to a unified manifesto, which they must satisfy first before they can implement their own policies?
conservatives and the right in general, I know I just criticized the notion of lumping them all together, but the general thing of conservative by definition is a reluctance and a resistance to change. And given that we have now the ability to use academia to point out things that do need to change, be it our reliance on fossil fuels, be it having the statistical knowledge to see that structural racism, structural inequality, be it on race, gender, ethnicity, etc., given that we now have the facts to know that those things exist, and given that the principle of equality is now firmly ingrained in most people's heads, we do know that things need to change in quite fundamental ways. And so you're going to get people that are reluctant to change, pushing against that. And so they will use the terms like New World Order to scare those who are resistant to change and to say, no, these people want to completely change your way of life. They want to break down the fabric of society, etc. And that's the sort of narrative that they use to discourage people. Moving just slightly back to the issue of what kind of politics are people interested in. I used to, as part of our Future Our Choice, visit schools on a regular basis and speak to 16, 17-year-olds about politics. And every single time, I would start the session by saying, all right, raise your hand here if you care about politics. And in many schools, not one hand would go up. And so my next question would be, all right, raise your hand if you care how much stuff costs in the shops. Every hand goes up. Raise your hand if you care whether or not you get a job when you leave school. Every hand goes up. Raise your hand if you care whether or not you can work in another country. Every hand goes up. And I say, that's politics. It's about making it relevant to people because people feel utterly disconnected and feel that the politics is just... I mean, me personally, when I was 18 and below, I would just see politics as this thing in Westminster with old people shouting at each other. Not something that would ever affect my life directly, whereas we're all seeing politics more and more, especially in recent couple of years, affect our daily lives very strongly.
Yeah, it's an amazing... I mean, what an amazing take on it, Femi. And I think you... Well, I'm sure there's a book coming from you at some point.
I mean, we'd be surprised if it wasn't, but then, I mean, just judging by the zeitgeist as you described, it's going to have to be an audio book because... People nowadays. But that's going back to the first question as well, Howard, because it's saying, you know, just the word politics has been indoctrinated into people to make most members of the laity switch off because they've been educated with the idea that that is a discipline or that is a field of study or knowledge that they're not involved in at that particular level. And the question is like, every tabloid...
That's one of the problems.
You can look on a tabloid and most average person would be able to break down the starting 11 for the England football team, but wouldn't be able to tell you five members of the cabinet. And that's not an insult to the population, but it's like, again, there is a social engineering whereby this political structure which governs the mechanics of your life is what most people are unaware of or have been trained to become adverse to it. Like, I was so crazy, like people say, no religion, no politics when you're in a pub. Well, in vino veritas, so people say what they fucking think when they've been drinking. Mm. And also, why wouldn't you discuss in an area where you're surrounded in a familiar surroundings, surrounded by your friends, would you not be able to have an honest and open conversation about topics which guide your fucking existence?
Exactly.
And I mean, we're going to move on to Dane's question in a sec, but I would say one thing that I think, you know, a lot of people can get their heads around. And I think when you're dealing with difficult people, it's often who are kind of quite maybe closed-minded or I think one thing that really helps to get across to them is what's gone is gone. And we do have to try and look forward and be progressive and solving our problems. And, you know, as a Jew, I can say, you know, we're definitely a group of people. We've definitely spent a lot of time thinking about the past and, you know, there's value to that, but it's also a real value to thinking about the future and what are going to be some solutions to these big problems we all face, no matter who you are or what your faults are. And I don't think that gets said enough personally. Maybe that was too dramatic, Dane. I don't know. Am I being too dramatic? This is me running for.
Well, why not? I mean, you know, inspired me. Again, I just remember growing up with the Monster Raven Looney Party, thinking that was very funny, and then getting older and realizing that's something that someone can do as a dalliance because they have so much money. Because I think for you to form a political party, is it like a minimum of 10 grand you need? And who's necessarily got that lying around?
Yeah, exactly. To spunk it up the wall like that guy did, but listen, it was great to hear you guys talk about that. And I know Dane's got a question up his sleeve for you, Femi, that I'm excited to hear what you think about.
Cool. Well, it's based on hopefully dovetailing the conversations we've had before in terms of our understanding of politics as they exist and also with Brexit. And I would go so far as to say, like most intense political issues, it's kind of been obscured from our vision and from our ears insofar as how Brexit is proceeding now. And I think people still are unaware of the effects. Anyway, I'm trying to be positive and negative. Well, I suppose I guess I'm going to be idealistic and romantic in that. Femi, you took up the mantle with a Sharpie and a T-shirt and decided to fight the good fight. And obviously, clearly, were astounded at the lack of awareness that people had about European policy. If you were given the task of drafting a trade deal with the EU, what key things need to be included in there in order to... Because, because what you've all said as well, Femi, is that you've taken the time to understand the needs of Leave voters, or to understand what led to their decisions. So if you could find a solution that would be a moderate solution for both sides, what would that consist of?
So the irony of my position is that I've been trying to unite both sides on an issue where the concept of compromise very much doesn't exist, even from a factual basis. So if you look at what Leave voters wanted and said they wanted, they wanted more control over their country. The idea of laws being made without their control and consent in Brussels in a foreign country, they didn't like that. They wanted British laws to be made in Britain. And they also argued that they could do that without damaging our standard of living at all by not damage trade. Now, the problem is that that doesn't really work. If you take Labour, for example, they tried to find a compromise. They said, all right, we will protect the free flow of goods and stuff that we buy from the EU and sell to the EU by staying in the single market, even though we've left the EU. Now, the problem with that was that meant that we would keep the economic benefits and therefore not really suffer economically, not suffer financially, but we'd be in the EU single market. Now, the single market is a system of rules, which means that anything made in the UK can be sold across the EU. But that means that the laws of the EU will still apply to the UK, but because we're no longer members of the EU, we'd no longer have a say in how those laws are made. And before Brexit, the UK had 73 of the 750 members of the European Parliament, which meant that mathematically, we had three times more voting power than the average EU country. That's a significant amount of say. And yet, the only version of Brexit that was possible to protect us economically is one that ended up with us following the same rules, but with no say, which is the exact opposite of what Brexit voters wanted. So as much as people talked about how we should find a compromise, there really wasn't one on the table because of a fundamental misunderstanding of what the EU was. Now, I say fundamental misunderstanding not to imply that just leavers were less educated than remainers, because I had to explain these topics to remainers largely so they could then have the conversations with leavers in a constructive way. That's what I spent most of my campaigning years doing. And it was so bad that I had to correct the BBC's definition of the single market in 2018. For about 6 months of 2018, this BBC's website defined the single market as basically a free trade deal, i.e. zero tariffs. Whereas in fact, that it's primarily to do with regulations. And the example that I regularly used was, imagine if you wanted to sell a product, let's say beer or pharmaceuticals, to every country, all 28 countries, but each country regulated pharmaceuticals or beer or whatever in different ways. You'd have to manufacture, market, and package your product in 28 different ways and comply with the regulatory checks, which would send your red tape costs through the roof. And we're seeing that today. We're seeing the problems of that at the borders damaging.
It's no longer hypothetical, is it?
It's no longer hypothetical. That's why the single market exists, because it creates barriers, which, by the way, hit smaller companies significantly more than larger companies. So giving multinational corporations a larger advantage and smaller companies the ones that suffer. And again, we're seeing that today. So what the EU does is it has a system of rules which are made commonly together in Brussels, but also a principle of mutual recognition, which means if the EU hasn't made a rule in a certain area, then as long as your product meets the requirements of your country, it can automatically be sold in all 28 countries. Now, that's the system that we've just left. So we could choose to sign a new trade deal that kept us within that system in order to prevent
a significant rise in poverty in the UK, but it would be the exact opposite of what Leave voters were expecting when they voted for Brexit.
And we are therefore going to end up where? is the fucking disastrous thing, right, Dane?
Yeah, I guess it remains to be seen. I mean, what we can all agree is that, like, David Cameron knew. He knew how bad this was. And the first time he tried to run away from his problems, he left his child in a pub. And then he was like, if they vote for this, I will fuck a pig again. And they were like, no way, David. That's ridiculous. That you know me. You know what I'm about. You know what I'm on. If they vote to leave, I'm fucking a pig, bro. No one is that dumb, bro. And then it happened and he was like, oh, my pig fucking days. And they were like, well, a bet is a bet, David. And he was like, I quit, y'all. It's crazy. It explains why it's so polarized, but it's just, again, relates to the fact that some of this is driven by logic and some of this is largely driven by emotion, and people have been able to manipulate this. Are there no policies about the EU that benefit even Leave voters without them realizing that we could implement and just tell them to shut up?
There are, in terms of the laws of the EU that Leave voters weren't aware of, I mean, Nigel Farage spread a narrative around immigration that immigration was completely unrestricted, whereas in fact the EU specifically has rules which say you can come here for more than 3 months if you either have a job or have sufficient resources not to become a burden on our welfare states and have your own comprehensive medical insurance. So that whole narrative of they come here, sponge off the NHS, live off benefits, that was a complete lie. So there were mechanisms on that.
Why did he lie, Femi? I don't understand.
Because he knows that essentially our country, I include myself in this to a large extent, was ignorant of the ways in which of how the EU affected us prior to 2016. And one of the reasons why we were so vulnerable to that level of manipulation is because every government, blue and red, for 40 years has had one single policy. If it's sunny, it's Westminster. If it's rainy, it's the EU. That's what we've been drip-fed by politicians for a very long time. Every directive the EU passed, which the UK then implemented, which was positive, the UK would take credit for it. Everything the EU did, which we felt was negative, even if it was us implementing it in the wrong way, again, blame the EU. And that's why we were so vulnerable to that level of misinformation.
Yeah. It's... I mean, you know, me and Dane have sat for the last couple of years doing this podcast, Femi. And fuck me, we've picked a pretty interesting time to be doing this.
Yeah.
And I do think one thing that comes up in my head when I hear, you know, listening to you guys talk, it's amazing to think how, you know, the phrase woke has been broken in so many respects now, but we are enlivened and charged to engage in a way that I think, I don't know if we were really doing before so much of, you know, obviously Brexit timed a similar time to a few other events that have seemed to have played some importance, including a reality star becoming president. And so to me, it just feels like, you know, that whilst there is this kind of, definitely now feels irreversible that we're out of the European Union, I don't think the mentality is irreversible on a grand scheme of things. I do think there is a way to, you know, fight back and find something, going back to the beginning, that feels logical as well as emotionally succinct with what people want.
But I'll touch on this at the end. The way you get there is by changing the voting system. It is that simple. You can't achieve change when the people who are standing in the way of change can get 100% of the power off a minority of the votes. You just can't do it. All the things that we need changed, for example, to address systemic racism by introducing blind CVs, right now, if you've got a Nigerian-sounding name, you have to send 80% more job applications to get a job offer. The Tories can change that tomorrow. They could change that tomorrow. They're choosing not to. They could improve the syllabus so that we learn more about history, more histories about other countries, rather than, I know for me, it was just World War One, World War Two.
And how ironic that all of our allies in those wars and all of our, we are now betraying all of our allies in these wars. How ironic. You're supposed to know it. We fought in a war, and now we've turned around and snaked every single person we fought along. And not only that, we even represent the same ideology as the people we fought against in the first place.
That's why. Last night, Nigel Farage was tweeting against the European Convention on Human Rights, which essentially came about as a response to the Nazis, which is insane.
How many times has God had to try and kill this man before people realize? If you get two helicopter crashes, who does that happen to? God is trying to kill this man. Clearly. Obviously. No one good doesn't have lips. Listen, you know, there's only two groups of people you throw milk on to kill them, okay? The lactose intolerant and demons. Everyone knows that. Even if you throw milk on me, I don't
Buffy the Vampire Slayer used to use that, right?
It means you're evil. Clearly.
Yeah,
it is a very good time.
I tell you what, working in TV, you know, I kind of often think we can help if we try.
If we really try. For the BBC, which is a government funded institution, and the Tories decide, I mean, it can be very difficult.
It's a very difficult scenario.
An equalities minister who no black person's ever met in their entire life saying that critical race theory is illegal. I mean, it's.
But also their whole mandate is forever kind of challenging its own existence by, you know, the need to for balance, which is obviously something that is almost impossible in many respects. But it lessens the impact of, you know, I mean, also the fact that they're saying they want balance and they've just put out 6 hours of Adam Curtis films is beyond me. But anyway, which are amazing, guys. You should check them out.
I just want to add as well on the subject of emotion and logic to MP Priti Patel. If your dad couldn't come here because of your immigration laws, you wouldn't exist.
Yep.
That's a Back to the Future that never got the chance to play out, right? That could.
Wait, is she trying to undo herself? Has she come back?
Maybe that's what she is. Maybe she realizes how bad it is that she's come back in time to be like, I should not.
She's the worst Marty McFly ever.
she's like in that film Alien Resurrection when there's like the half Ripley, half alien, and he just goes, kill me.
Yeah.
Because it realizes it's an abomination.
On that bombshell, it's been a great episode today.
Dude, bombshell, Howard, that's barely a firecracker. Like, it's so good.
On that note, no, we are going to wrap up today's episode, which has been, you know, we do so many different types of episode on this show, and it was such a political episode today, Dane. But I think people want that.
I think people do. I think the only issue with politics is the fact that it's political. I think the nomenclature associated with bipartisan politics is what people do not like. But I think anyone discussing ideas and belief systems that dictate their lives are of most importance to everyone. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's political, but I think everything is. That's the problem.
Well, I think what you've done, Femi, is, you know, inspirational and heroic. You know, really, I mean, I don't often use those terms, but, you know, what you've done, and I hope you continue your good work, and it's really been a joy to have you with us today.
Appreciate it. And the one thing I'd say, if we're talking about things I can promote, is we need to fix the voting system. So Make Votes Matter is the biggest organization that's pushing to reform the voting system. If you're in Labour, push for Labour for PR to get more and more strength within the Labour Party so that we can get Labour to commit to electoral reform. Because if we do make it so that every vote counts equally, then more people will get engaged in politics because they will feel their vote matters, rather than being stuck in constituencies where they know the Tories are going to win regardless of what they do. So we need to get more people engaged in politics by making politics fairer.
Absolutely. So this has been amazing. So for me, for people that want to find more about the works you've done or previous works, and for this upcoming book / political manifesto that we know you're going to need, where can our listeners find you, please?
So I'm at Femi_sorry on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and also TikTok, which is new. So I've tried to keep a balance between that, doing that, and miming, doing little dances, and COD, of course, the COD videos. But yeah, that's where I'm at.
Lovely. Call of Duty, right?
Yes.
For old people like me, not fish. No, just because there's some people who are old on this show, they might not, you know. Yeah, not me.
Because people will be like, now this liberal's getting our fish. We fought for that fish. We fought for that fish. And now he's got it. We fought for them seas back. Fishing back from British. And that firm is taking them. What's happened to my country?
Yeah, it's definitely me and not Brexit that's fucked the fishing industry.
Femi, respect, and thank you again for coming on our show.
Pleasure.
Thank you
so much. And,
pleasure.
Please do stay in touch, man. I'd love to know more about what you're doing, and hopefully we can see you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Femi Oluwole. You can follow Femi on Twitter and Instagram at Femi_sorry. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks to Polly, Gelly and the Acast team for all their support. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.